1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
What's happening, Higher Side Chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. I'm Greg Carlwood, doing what I do in sunny Sandy. Welcome to THC. Today, our guest is going to be Kent Bain, who wrote the book, the most dangerous book in the world, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual, as well as a few follow-ups connecting the occult dots and some of the more recent tragedies of 2012. But before we take that serious double axel swan dive into the depths of Satan's asshole, we got to get some positive vibes flowing. And with me today, fulfilling just such a need after a fairly long hiatus, is the ever groovy Adam Go Rightly. Adam, man, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's going well. I'm trying to test out these headphones. My cat was chewing on them. I don't know if he chewed on them too much or not enough.
Damn cats.
I think they'll work. One side's kind of messed up, but I'm deaf in one ear, so that's fine.
Yeah, I got a cat, chews on all kinds of shit.
They're awesome.
Yeah.
A lot less maintenance than dogs.
Oh, yeah. Or kids.
Right, yeah. I don't even think about that, but yeah, if your cat dies, you don't go to jail. Yeah, so anyway, you got any further on those book projects? You want to talk about them at all?
Yeah, they're coming along. There's a few of them. Kind of related to a bunch of materials on Discordianism that were passed on to me. So there's going to be a book on the history of Discordianism and some other rarities. For people who don't know Discordianism, it's kind of hard to talk about some of this stuff without having folks' eyes gloss over. But for those into Discordianism, it's going to be some pretty cool stuff coming out here in the next couple of years.
So is Discordianism a philosophy? Is it a point of view? Is it a cult, a religion?
All of those things and none of those things. It is a quote-unquote spoof religion created by a couple of guys, Kerry Thornley and Greg Hill, back in the late 50s as just kind of an in-joke between them. And as time progressed and they got into the 60s, other people got involved with it. And it became kind of like a surrealist art movement in a sense. And what Discordianism is the worship of the Greek goddess of chaos and discord, Eris. And it's different for everybody, and anybody can join the religion and become a pope and start their own branch of Discordianism. My handle in Discordianism is the Wrong Reverend Houdini Kundalini of the Church of Unwavering Indifference.
Yes, yeah, it definitely has a sense of humor. It seems like, yeah, almost like a joke in some sense, because you start looking at this, you're like, what is this? You know, I dug into it a little bit. I'm like, what is this? And it all just seems to be jokes, you know.
Well, perhaps, but Kerry Thornley, who was the co-founder of Discordianism, had later on in his life, he thought that he really might have been stirring up some chaotic forces that he hadn't intended to deal with. I got into all this stuff when I was writing my book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy, researching Thornley's connection to the JFK assassination. I didn't know a lot about Discordianism then, but that's how I kind of got introduced to it. Then a few years back, fellow Bob Newport, who was another co-founder of Discordianism, had all the original Discordian archive files of Greg Hill, who was the main dude behind Discordianism, and those were passed on to me, and so this has resulted in all these different projects. But with Kerry Thornley, you know, he knew Oswald in the Marines and was actually writing a book about Oswald prior to the JFK assassination. And then later, Thornley became was indicted by Jim Garrison. Garrison, you know, claimed that Thornley was one of the, involved in that whole nexus of spooks in New Orleans that Garrison claimed were behind the JFK assassination. And Garrison later suspected that the Discordian Society was some kind of crazy CIA front and assassination bureau.
Damn.
Thornley helped promote these theories when Garrison had somebody on his staff who believed that the Bavarian Illuminati was also involved in the assassination. When Thornley heard this, you know, back in the late 60s when Garrison was after his ass, he started promoting these theories that the Discordian Society was somehow involved with the Bavarian Illuminati. All this craziness later came and bit carry on the ass, you know, at, all this Discordianism came full circle, and a lot of chaos and nuttiness entered his life. And he later on, even after the Garrison investigation, he came to realize that maybe Garrison was on the right track, and that Kerry had been unwittingly sucked into this JFK assassination conspiracy.
Damn.
That's a crazy story, and it's in my book, The Prankster and the Conspiracy. And this latest project I'm working on, tentatively called Caught in the Crossfire, Kerry Thornley and the Garrison Investigation, gets into all of this a bit deeper.
Very cool. Do you have any idea when that's going to be out? Are you still working on it?
It's... first draft, it's completed, and I'm actually conversing with a publisher today about it, so see how that will go.
Yeah.
I know I'll get published somewhere. I'm just got to working through the details here of who that will be.
Well, cool, man. Good luck on that.
Yeah,
looks like it's about that time. Ken's probably waiting for a ring. Which means it's conspiracy t-shirt plug-in time with conspiracies.net. How are yours working out for you, man? The Squid of Power. I know you've had it on. I mean, it's got a pretty definite hypnotic effect on beautiful women. Have you been experiencing that?
Yeah, the chicks dig it.
Very awesome, man. Well, you know, it's getting hard out there for a pimp, so buy my shirts. It gets a little bit easier, and we'll be right back with Kent Bain.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
Well, there's no doubt that most Higher Side chatters see the events of 9/11 as your textbook example of a modern-day false flag attack, but that's a far too simplistic of an understanding for such a complex string of events that are just completely soaked and lathered in occult symbolism, dark magic, mass trauma-based mind control, and plenty of homage to the dark idols of these shadowy puppet masters. Lucky for us stupid stoners, today's guest, Kent Bain, has penetrated layers of the 9/11 onion I didn't even know were there, which he's detailed at length in his new book entitled The Most Dangerous Book in the World, 9/11 as a Mass Ritual. And he's here with Adam Gorightly and I to demystify some of the stranger aspects of that tragic event. Kent, welcome to THC.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really appreciate you being here. It's a pleasure. The book is fascinating with an entertaining and humorous tone, not to mention connection after connection. The ritualistic and occult aspects of events, this is an area I've been really interested in lately, but it's tough to understand a language you don't speak, you know, and I don't have much of a foundation for occult meaning and symbolism. So I end up just trying to put things together like a kid trying to make a baby with two Barbie dolls, you know, just awkwardly banging them together, trying to figure out how this shit works. But, I mean, let's start with you, though, man. As I understand it, you didn't come to the events in 9/11 with a background in this stuff either. So how long was that process? What were the first few odd threads you started pulling that really made this whole angle unravel for you?
Well, I didn't. You're right. I didn't come to the scene with a background in the occult or in symbolism or anything of that nature. And as a matter of fact, I came to the whole 9/11 truth movement later than most. It was 4 or 5 years ago when I really started looking into it seriously. And then it wasn't too long after that that I really began to pick up on some threads that I thought were significant and dig deeper, and that led into the occult research. But yeah, I was asleep at the wheel for a long time, and then coming to it so late, I really had the benefit of a lot of good research that had already been done, and a lot of people that had already begun to explore the area of the occult with relation to 9/11. So there were a lot of things that I could there were a lot of pieces of the puzzle laying around for me to pull together. So it wasn't all original research or original thinking on my part. And I acknowledge that, you know, in the book, and then I always like to mention that in interviews, is that, you know, that this was a big collaboration on the part of, you know, dozens and dozens of people that I've never actually met, but whose work I've drawn from. So, you know, it was like a crowdsourcing effort. I came to it, really trying to make sense of a lot of the individual pieces of evidence that don't fit, that seem suspicious. And I thought, after I'd encountered enough of them, I thought, well, there's got to be an explanation for this, and I'll look into it, and it'll, you know, I can just make it all go away, and I'll be able to sleep better at night. But the entirely the opposite happened, and the more that I dug around and the more I looked into it, the more evidence of that nature was there, and the uglier the picture got. And then as I did research into the occult and began to figure out what was going on and have some sense of it, and I began to research occult ritual and psychological warfare, I had to do a quick study in a lot of different topics, including astrotheology and occult symbolism. And so it was a huge crash course for me, and what I tried to do in the book was not inundate the reader with too much about any particular subject, and, you know, too much about the numerology or the astrology, but just enough to understand the what I refer to as the occult script for 9/11. So even if a reader or listener comes to it completely fresh, there's enough there that you'll understand it, and I set the context for the entire discussion, and then kind of background people on the specific symbols that are used and so forth. But yeah, it was certainly an eye-opening experience for me, and a real journey, educational process, and I try to make it an easier experience for the reader, and then also throw in heavy doses of humor, because it's such a difficult and heavy subject that, you know, I wouldn't want to read a completely serious book on this subject. And another thing I'll just point out is that as I got into it, there were definite just heavy overtones of dark humor, black humor throughout this occult script. And we can touch on that a bit as we go forward. But humor... I mean, you couldn't write in a completely serious way about something that entailed so much dark humor that, when it was used for the purpose of, you know, mockery and, I suppose the entertainment of those who orchestrated this event. But, yeah, that's kind of the long process that I went through.
Yeah, I love the tone of the book, because you're presenting such heavy information. A lot of it has, you know, you got to give some history to it, and then you're just kind of like, and there's one connection, and then you're like, if that's not enough, here's another one, and here's another one, and do with this one what you will. And, you know, just I like that matter-of-fact tone, and because it's such, you know, you're dealing with dark material, and you know, you're just kind of like, well, you know, connection after connection, you know, do whatever you want with it. It's just it's good. It's a great read.
Well, the cumulative weight of the evidence is what's convincing. And, you know, when you have to lay out a lot of different dots and then connect them, that can be a bit tedious. But the reward, the payoff is worth it, because when you pay attention long enough and you look at the dots and you recognize patterns and then you see the connections, then you start to see this framework or architecture for the event. And not just in an entirely joking manner, refer to it as the occult script, because it was highly scripted. And, you know, who knows if they all had a playbook they were all reading from, but that wouldn't be too far-fetched, because you can reconstruct the script in a very detailed way. And it was the result of, you know, a lot of creativity, hard work, and blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah. Well, let's look at some of these dots under the microscope. I mean, I would say that one of the occult connections that I've heard addressed the most before your book was the Twin Towers were a modern representation of the Pillars of Hermes, which, you know, never really meant anything to me, but your book spends a good amount of time on this. Can you explain to the people some of the justification for this connection, other than them just being two structures with a similar phallic form? There's a little more to it, right?
Well, there's a lot more to it. And what you'll find with the symbols, if you just look into them in general, you know, various symbols, including the Pentagon and the Pillars of Hermes, they'll have multiple interpretations and meanings depending on the time period, the context, who is utilizing the symbols. Of course, with 9/11, we're dealing with a black mass, black magic ritual, so we'd use the dark interpretation or connotation of the symbols. But with the Pillars of Hermes, you could also see the Twin Towers as, you know, massive concrete and steel representations of the Twin Pillars of Freemasonry. And with a lot of the symbols, there are, even from a, you know, if you're just considering the dark arts, there are multiple layered references, and so it's not just one thing. And I tend to think they get additional points for that type of thing, in, you know, when they're looking at these rituals and patting each other on the back. But there are multiple references, multiple interpretations that I go through in the book about the significance of the Pillars of Hermes, specifically Hermes as a god of commerce, god of trade, god of trickery, and it's in part an invocation of the trickster archetype. And of course, 9/11 was a gigantic false flag act of just mass trickery, and so what they were doing was invoking the god of trickery, the trickster himself, Hermes, who is also recognized as Thoth or and various other deities. But with the Pillars of Hermes, they weren't just supersized symbols. They were used in a way to invoke the spirit of this particular deity. And we need to make a little side note here.
Sure.
Just like there can be multiple interpretations for the symbols, they can be invoking different deities with the same symbol or with the same act. And so where they're invoking Hermes, of course, when you stand back and do kind of a meta-analysis on the entire day's events, I mean, it has strong Luciferian satanic overtones, but it's really complicated, textured, it's very sophisticated, and, you know, even though we could view it as a Luciferian mega ritual, it's not exclusively so. So they're invoking these deities, and they pay homage to and worship multiple deities, Hermes being chief among them. And so that was, you know, in a sense, declaring the overall nature of the day's events, because the Twin Towers were the first objects, mass symbols that were and utilized and invoked that day. And of course, they went on to be used as I cover in several chapters as, you know, mass altars or sacrificial vessels. So you start to drill and drill down further and further and peel the onion, and there are lots of different layers, but it's not super sophisticated. You just have to take it in a methodical fashion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what makes it so hard to swallow for some people, because we're used to an A to B connection, and this is kind of like a spider web of connections, you know? And so
absolutely,
people are like, well, what does it represent? Does it represent this, or does it represent this? And if you can't tell them one or the other, they don't really understand the occult things.
Right.
But to me, it's almost like the one problem with it, or criticism, is it's almost like a horoscope, in that it can be interpreted multiple ways. It can be fairly vague. So it's sort of up to the individual to kind of to make those connections, or decide if they're strong enough connections to see something. But I mean, when you pile them on by the tons, you know, you got to look at it and say, can there really just be all these coincidences to occult symbolism? It seems a little bit far-fetched there. But one interesting aspect to the Twin Towers is that when you go into it, it almost seems like, and it's a scary thought, but it seems like this plan might have been in action for a long time, like almost to the building of the towers themselves, if possible.
Several years ago, I would have laughed at that idea.
Right. Yeah, but it seems scary.
Myself. But like you, when you first said at the beginning of the interview, the conclusions are difficult to grasp and wrestle with, because it's when you layer all the evidence, draw the connections, and then let the evidence tell the story, and then base the conclusions on that. That's when you have trouble making things go away and dispelling them, because you're left with really uncomfortable conclusions that conflict with your, you know, in many instances with your worldview and the way that you perceive that the world operates. And you really don't want to think about a group of people with such psychopathic character having such power and influence that not only can they pull off a massive false flag attack and not a single person go to jail, but then on top of that, the very same set of events is somehow orchestrated as a super sophisticated occult ritual mind control operation. To think about those types of individuals being able to manipulate us, manipulate our democracy, our republic, the institutions of government, and power, essentially with no limitations on what they can accomplish, that's really scary. And most people want to dismiss it. And of course, you start to get over into this commonly held stereotype of the New World Order and the sort of James Bond mad scientist who's, you know, got this plan to rule the world. And so you're left with some really challenging conclusions, but the evidence is what, you know, forced me to draw some of these conclusions, and I still wrestle with the implications. And
right.
I think most people do. And and then further, once you start to examine some of these issues and think about the possible implications, then, you know, you're left with not a lot of good ideas for what to do about it. I mean, it's not as if you see the problem and then immediately have dozens of ideas for how to combat it or how to overcome the power structure. So it's not fun reading, and it's not any fun once you get through reading it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely challenging, but let's look at some of the examples, because one of the things that I thought was really interesting, like this definitely raised some eyebrows, is you have a section called the 11-year countdown, which, you know, starts with Bush Sr.'s speech on 9/11 of 1990, which is that Bush speech that everyone talks about. That's the one where he mentions the New World Order, and that is like literally 11 years to the day. And then Another interesting side note is that the building that is being built at Ground Zero now is called One World Trade Center. And,
right.
I mean, there it is, you know. And it also, you know, another thing you point out in the book is that it has 1,776 stories, and 1776 is the year the Illuminati was formed. Wow, you know, if that doesn't give you a conspiracy boner, are you alive?
Well, yeah, so Poppy Bush announces it, and then 11 years later it happens, and then 11 years after that we get Benghazi, and then they're milking that for all it's worth. I mean, the 11 is connected with the Twin Towers, and it's one of the numbers of power that are incorporated into the whole ritual, and it's the number of magic, and Aleister Crowley claimed it as his number, and so like you said, if you don't know the language, then you're not going to understand any of this. But when you understand how important all the numbers and symbols are, that is literally part of an occult language that they use, and a way that they communicate with each other in plain sight, that's how they do these things. They don't just orchestrate them in secret. I mean, they part of the what makes these mass public rituals so compelling and so exciting for them is they do them, and they're leaving these clues just right out in front of us. But because
virus database has been updated,
talk about it a bit in the book, because of symbol illiteracy, we don't see these things. We just see buildings. We just see planes. We don't know to pay attention to the numbers or to the constructs, the buildings themselves, and so they can perform these gigantic rituals right before us, and we're none the wiser. So the 11, you know, being used repeatedly and at various points throughout the ritual, that's a constant, and that's something that at some point I just quit paying attention. I found enough 11s to convince myself that was, one of their key numbers, and then I just quit chronicling the appearance of the 11, because you can really get carried away with that. I mean, of course you can get carried away with numerology, and you can find 11s in everything. But I mean, of course the number 11 was the flight number of the plane that hit the first tower, and then you kind of go down the list in importance from there. But it was definitely one of the numerical stars of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Kent, I have a question. You talk about these mass rituals, you know, and we can go back to the JFK assassination all the way through 9/11 and recent shootings. You know, there's a form of mind control that you hear about in conspiracy lore called trauma-based mind control, and we're talking about subjects, Manchurian candidate types. They use this type of trauma-based mind control to basically control the victim. Do you think this is what's happening on a larger scale? It's another form of trauma-based mind control to condition and program folks using these things, like, once again, the JFK assassination or 9/11?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what I wanted to do with the book was use 9/11 as really a case study. But, you know, for those that aren't familiar with these mass rituals, and then once you see the architecture of the mass rituals, then, of course, you can look backwards, you can look forwards. And we've got the most recent example of Sandy Hook. And the 9/11 is the grandest example that we have. So it was a good case study, but certainly you can use it to then begin to dissect other rituals. And to your point about the trauma-based mind control, or psychological programming, what they found, the practitioners of these mind control experiments, was that the occult aspects of the rituals were the most effective in producing trauma. They generated maximum trauma on the for the victim and therefore maximum susceptibility to the subsequent programming. And we can take that and apply it to the scale of mass consciousness, to the general public, the global public, you know, and view the media as the conduit through which they're generating the psychological trauma on the scale of global consciousness. And so you're dead on that is, it is a form of mass trauma-based mind control. It's a, you know, a gigantic psychological warfare operation. And then, and you know, it's, it of course didn't just traumatize the nation on one day. I mean, you know, you have so many different cues from the images that are, you know, shown repeatedly on television to, you know, just the there are so many things that just conjure up the pain over and over again. And you know, we were treated to a big round of it on the 10th anniversary year before last. It is just, you know, documentaries and news programs and special editions of magazines, and it's just they continue to use that tool and bring it back up and you know, generate further injury and keep that wound open to keep us scared, keep us in a state of perpetual fear and terror, so that we are at their mercy. It's we're you know, have a victim mentality, and we're completely susceptible to whatever they want to do to us. I mean, they, you know, essentially they put us in a position of asking them to do what they want to do to begin with. But
yeah,
and that gets over into the issue of consent, and I deal with that in the book. But it's the main point is that it produces the results they want, regardless of, you know, the issue of consent, or, you know, how sophisticated the technology is, or how many different ways they beat us over the head. It produces exactly the results they want, and they have it down to a science, and it's very powerful and very sophisticated.
Well, let's look at some of these things, some of these weird coincidences that are a little easier to digest for people. I mean, for example, one that's I think pretty easy to grasp is George Bush's role and actions on that day, and the Satanism connection. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. And what we need to keep in mind is that, of course, there are genuine synchronicities produced by, you know, depends on your worldview really as to, you know, how synchronicities actually operate. But what
True.
You'll find in these types of rituals is they generate purposefully these artificially engineered synchronicities. And so they that's part of why you tend to want to chalk it up to coincidence, because it appears, you know, it just looks a little funny, but you can't quite figure it out. But they do that on a just a broad scale with these types of rituals, and then with 9/11 specifically. But so we've got on the morning of September 11th, George W. Bush sitting in a Sarasota, Florida classroom, and he's being treated to a story by a group of I believe second graders, and it's the pet goat, which, you know, seems innocent enough until you place all of that in broader context and understand 9/11 as a mass ritual, on some level a black mass, and the episode in Sarasota really was intended to be a black mass, and the reading of this particular children's story was intended to invoke the goat-headed deity Baphomet, and as representative really of any number of things, but it fits right in with the Luciferian spirit of the day. But if you've never watched the video of Bush in the classroom, you should listen to the instructional style that was used in the children reading the book, and it has a very sort of ritual-like quality to it. And
right.
Then there's the fact that Bush didn't get up for 7 minutes after he was informed that America was under attack. I think his chief of staff whispered in his ear, and that's a really interesting episode, because you've got those facts and then a number of others that I present in that chapter, but then just the fact of where Bush is that morning, is one of these artificially engineered synchronicities I was referring to. Muhammad Atta, the purported ringleader of the 9/11 hijackings and the pilot of American Airlines Flight 11 that hit the first tower, he actually undertook part of his flight training in Sarasota. He took a little bit more training at the Venice Municipal Airport, which is about 10 miles south of Sarasota. But for Bush, on the very morning that the attacks occurred, to be sitting in a town where the ringleader of the attacks took flight training, it's just absurd to think that that's a pure coincidence. And that's one of those types of things that really throws you off at first, but then once you have it in context, you kind of get it. It's part of the joke. Mm-hmm. As it, you know, and it's also, there are there's a kind of a well documented history of the CIA using the Venice airport for its drug running operations, and so it was a tip of the hat to Poppy Bush and the CIA's activities in that area. So you got, that's kind of a multi-layered little tip of the hat to any number of things there, you know. And of course, who's governor of Florida at that time? It's Jeb Bush, you know, little brother Jeb Bush. And so it's kind of an all in the family affair there in Sarasota. And you know, you can rightly view George W., the commander in chief, really as the high priest of a black mass that was being conducted. And that, you know, it's, you think, well, he's in Florida and the attacks are in Washington and Shanksville and New York. It's you know, in their mind, it's all connected on the astral level, and he's presiding over this whole series of events and kind of initiating the day and really serving to oversee this gigantic really occult script as it's being played out. And so he helped kick off the day's events that morning, and of course they lasted well into the latter part of the day. But you just, when you link all the different pieces of evidence together, you see exactly what they were doing. And again, what's difficult to really come to terms with is a lot of it does, you might see some occult significance, and in many instances you do, but then in other instances, that the only conclusion that you can draw, for some of the inclusions of some of these different points or facts, is that it was just done for kicks, just as an insider joke, or as a, you know, to acknowledge something that is of meaning to them, that it's just a big joke. So
yeah, I think that looking at Bush on that day is pretty telling. I mean, there are no other animals that represent a demon in the way that the goat head does, you know. So I mean, that is, that connection loose? I mean, that's up to the individual to decide, but if you haven't heard the kids reading on that day, you have to. And in fact, I mean, I can have edit this out if it doesn't work out well, but I'm going to try to play it through YouTube. I think all three of us will be able to hear it, and I think it will record, but I'm going to give it a shot.
Okay.
Get ready to read all these words on this page without making a mistake. Look at the letter at the end and remember the sound it makes. Get ready.
Kite.
Yes, kite. Get ready to read this word the fast way. Get ready.
Kite.
Yes, kite. Sound it out. Get ready.
Kite.
Sound it out. Get ready.
Kite.
What word?
Kite.
Yes, kite. Boys and girls, sound this word out. Get ready.
Steel.
What word?
Steel.
Yes, steel. Read these words the fast way. Get ready.
Play.
Yes, play. Get ready.
Must.
Yes, must. Let's read these words the fast way without making a mistake. Get ready.
Kite.
Yes, kite. Get ready.
Kit.
Yes, kit. Get ready.
Steel.
Yes, steel. Get ready.
Play.
Yes, playing. Get ready.
Must.
Yes, must.
Okay, that actually worked out, but I mean, there's so many words, so many damn words kids could be reciting, but on the day of 9/11, they're reciting kite, hit, steal, plane, must. I mean, kite is a little off, but hit, steal, plane, must, I mean, that sounds occultish to me, and it also sounds very coincidental to what happened on that day.
You might want to edit this out. This is all right if we just kind of background you a little bit on that. That really seems compelling. When you look at the high-definition version of that video, and you can see the words they're reciting, they're not those words. They sound like them.
Really?
And you know, yeah, I mean, who knows? I mean, that might be close enough for ritual purposes, but the person that did that, the video that you're looking at, was going based on what it sounded like the kids were saying, but when you look at the high-def version and you can see the words on the board that the stage is pointing to, it's... I forget what the words are, but they're not those four words.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I would keep it in there because I know that that's a popular video. I've had that video sent to me many times. I think it's important that if it's not legitimate, that people know that. There's tons of stuff to look at, but it is important to know because that's one of the most popular ones. If that's not legitimate, then, yeah, I would like people to know that.
Well, and, again, I went into this trying to disconnect the dots and not connect them and ended up having to reverse my... attitude on things, but the back to the symbol of the goat, the use of the goat, the story of children's story. You know, one of the things that I did was, you know, I tried to really assess whether or not, you know, this particular symbol or link was valid, or you know, was it tenuous? And with the goat specifically, when you do the research, and I think I put enough in the book to probably convince the reader and the listener, it is such a powerful symbol historically and in contemporary terms to the Freemasons, as well as representing and invoking Baphomet, that, you know, when you do it, provide enough background, that really helps the reader get it, because I didn't realize how important it was. But when you understand the symbols and numbers, and then the system of thought and the broader context for some of these symbols and what it represents, then you catch on, then you're able to understand it, and you might, and then it's more than just a bit of an interesting note, or an interesting link. The presence of the goat was, a really intentionally woven in, and I people are right to be skeptical about all of this, but then when you do the background research and you're able to establish context and then show how the symbol was used and the broader event that day, then that begins to fill in some of the blanks and answer some of the questions and make things seem a little bit more certain. Now, certainly people are right to continue to question any piece of evidence or the whole scenario, but it gets a little bit more firm with each chapter. You get mm-hmm. A little bit more evidence, and then at the end, of course, I try to tie everything together in a comprehensive way. But yeah, I started out, I wanted it to all go away, and it wouldn't.
Well, when you do face skeptics and you tell them what your book is about, and they kind of step back and they say, give me an example. You know, what would you cite as like a quick and easy kind of one of the strongest examples that there's a Satanist element to 9/11 or a ritual element?
Well, see, I've got a ready-made answer for that.
Good.
And I'm not sidestepping your question, and I'll come back and give you some examples. But the broader truth is that there's no one example that's going to be entirely convincing. It's the cumulative weight of evidence, and that's what convinced me, and that's what allowed me to, really characterize the entire event in the way that I have, and really talk about it in detailed terms, and present this, rather complete occult script for the various components of 9/11, from what took place in D.C. and New York and Shanksville and White Horse, Alaska. It's the cumulative weight that is convincing and compelling. As to the aspects that of the entire day's events that qualify it in my mind as a Luciferian or satanic ritual. Probably in every chapter there's something that you can point to, a very powerful piece of evidence, to say, well, you know, that's exactly what you would expect to find in context of a black mass or a satanic ritual, and then those just layer one on top of another. One example I'll give you, in looking at the Twin Towers, again, this is you have to keep in mind the broader script, you have the use of a very powerful fire symbol in the Twin Towers themselves, and the chief architectural element of the Twin Towers was the trident. You can see it in any, thousands and thousands of photographs of the Twin Towers, but the exterior of the towers were these repeated trident symbols that cast in steel that wrapped all the way around the buildings. And the trident is a well-known fire symbol. It's the weapon of Satan, if you will. Satan is not holding a pitchfork, it's a trident, and that's a classical fire symbol. And so the Twin Towers themselves were these massive sacrificial vessels that were literally wrapped in a fire symbol. And in context of all of the other evidence, from the goat to these blatant human sacrifices to the numerology and the astrology that you find just scattered all over the place on 9/11, it absolutely has the overtones of a gigantic satanic ritual. Now, as we discussed earlier, it's not exclusively so, I go into a short dialogue in the book about, are these all of the people that were in the upper echelons and responsible for orchestrating this event, or are they hardcore, true-believing Satanists? And I would have and do have some question about that. I think there's some that absolutely there's some that are committed practicing Luciferians and practitioners of the dark arts, but then I'm sure there's some that are just along for the ride and just go along with all of that because it produces the results they desire, and they get their cut, and so they just go along with the overall plan because it benefits them. But I was left with no question that on some level, regardless of the attitude of the orchestrators of the event towards it, but on some level it was absolutely a massive Luciferian ritual.
Hey, Ken, I have a question about, talking about this, the occult symbolism, and a lot of that doesn't seem readily apparent, to the average Joe, unless you dig a bit deeper, as you have. But, do you think this occult symbolism, at least it seems to me, it works, can work on a subconscious level, planting these images in the group mind? And, this brings me back to, don't know if you're familiar with James Shelby Downard and the research he did. Yeah, I talked about what he called the revelation of the method and the making manifest of all that's unseen, that it's a subtle processing. And it seems, like I was saying, it's not, these symbols aren't readily apparent, but I think over the years they have become more mainstream. You're starting to see all this Illuminati symbolism. Kind of a long-winded question there, and I'm not sure what it is, but do you agree with that, that it's used on a subconscious level?
Yeah, I very much do. Somewhat depends on, your own personal belief or perspective as to, whether or not ritual magic, whether white or black, actually works, and your attitudes and beliefs about the supernatural. And but there's you know, good evidence that the those that pulled off this mega ritual are very powerful believers in this you know, in black magic. And just like subliminal programming is known to be effective, and of course there are various tactics within psychological warfare that you know, are proven beyond a shadow of a doubt. The there's good evidence and that the intended effect of these symbols, whether or not we recognize them, activate within us on a subconscious level various powers and forces, and you know, even invoke energies from the astral planes and do things to us that we just can't even begin to imagine, and that so that we're not just being exposed to these symbols, but they're actually operating at archetypal subconscious level and programming our consciousness and influencing us at the level of spirit and being, and it, you know, that's the part, you know, that you would really hope was not true.
Yeah.
That, because of, in addition to everything else that they're doing, if they're performing some grand, you know, alchemical transmutation of human consciousness for their own purposes, you know, and seeking to, you know, change the course of human evolution and the, you know, the evolution of our consciousness and warp it to their dark purposes, then, you know, if there's truth to that, and there's good evidence that they have a strong belief that their practices and techniques are effective, then that puts this into an entirely different realm. I mean, if we entertain the idea of supernatural forces and supernatural evil, and okay, well, you know, did they have did the orchestrators of this 9/11 ritual have some type of aid from non-human forces? Were they performing some magic spell, not just a ritual, but weaving some kind of spell that took effect and is still in effect and unleashed demonic forces on the landscape? I don't get into that in the book, but those questions are raised and you know, are certainly there, and it depends on where you are in your own thinking and on all of those issues.
Well, that kind of brings me to my next question, and maybe this will be in part two of your book, but you talk about the occult script. Well, who has written this script? Who's the author or authors, and are they perhaps superhuman deities like Hermes, who's influencing humans? Who do you think, is this a script that was written long ago, or is this a script that different scripts continue to be written? That's kind of a big question, but
it is a big question, and I don't know that I have the answers. I think that this ritual is particular ritual is of a type that has, of course, been employed before, undertaken before, and you know, we've discussed a bit the JFK killing of the king ritual, but the you know, it's a grand example of a type of ritual that has been performed multiple times throughout history, but it's difficult to really say. And I forgot the second part of your question.
Who authors the script? Do we even know?
I don't think we'll ever know, because whoever is at the top, whoever's pulling the strings at the highest levels, I mean, they're obviously able to manipulate the defense and intelligence agencies of various countries, including the United States, with total effectiveness. And you know, they either there were either individuals within the CIA and DOD that were complicit or that were manipulated in ways that they couldn't conceive of. But I don't really try to, in the book, get into, you know, the whodunit. And I do talk about some of the logical suspects, but that is such a broad issue, and it's so hard to come up with any real answers that I, for the most part, left it alone. I mean, the stereotypical answer that you would probably give to that question, as well as the Illuminati, well, that doesn't tell you anything.
Right.
But, I mean, there are various think tanks and organizations and families that are associated with these types of events, and you hear all about them on Alex Jones, and there's lots of people have written about the Illuminati and the Club of Rome and the Bilderberg Group and so forth. But I mean, those wouldn't be the types of entities or agencies that would be writing the script for this event, or were at the top of the pyramid. And so I don't think we'll ever know, have any clue who the key actors were. All you can really do is infer from the evidence who would have had to have been involved, or which agencies would have had to have been either complicit or duped. And then, if you can follow the trail back upstream further from that, then you've done a hell of a lot of research, because they have purposely insulated themselves. And not to be pessimistic, but I think even if you could get a clue as to who was involved, you could not touch them. There's not a judicial body on the planet, including the international courts, that could hold these people accountable. They own everything. They own,
right.
These are the people that own the international banks, the multinational corporations. They, who are you going to send to arrest them, even if you could identify them? And who's
exactly
going to try them? What institution are you going to try them within? So
yeah, it is tough, because you can look at the Bush family and the Skull and Bones and their little group, and you can be like, oh, they're pretty high up there. But it's like, you don't know. There could be 10 levels above them. They could be working for people that they fear in ways that would make you laugh. It's kind of like I say about Freemasons, just to say, people say, 33 degree is the highest degree. I'm like, that may be the highest degree people talk about. There could be a level above that no one who's reached that level would ever talk. It could go to 100, but after 33, that's when they really separate the wheat from the chaff. You never really know. It's only what comes out. But
you're entirely right about that.
It is a crazy thing. And I mean, but before we go, I really do want to spend some time on your ebook, because it brings it into more current events, the same line of thinking. But you've got this ebook on your website. It is free. I think it's a must read for anybody who's listening. It's called A Warning: Aurora, Sandy Hook, and the Valley of Ashes. Can you tell us a bit about this trilogy of attacks that you theorize on? And since we're so close to May 10th, which is a big, potentially a big date in this line of thinking.
Yeah, the one thing about the study and analysis of 9/11 and similar events is that you can begin to try to predict what they might do, when they might do it in the future. When you understand that these false flag events have, in most instances, some type of occult component, then you can start to look for the occult architecture, and then that could potentially help you nail down dates and locations and that type of thing. I mean, it's really you wouldn't want to spend your life on it. You could waste a whole lot of time on it. But there have been a number of things that have jumped out at me connected to the Aurora, Colorado shooting and the Sandy Hook. There's an astrological connection between the two, dealing with the crescent moon, and our controllers are involved in the enterprise of blurring the line between reality and fantasy, and so that's part of why they leave clues and hints. Specifically in this instance in Batman, that Dark Knight Rises and other films, they're you know, things are manifesting on celluloid that then turn out to have bearing in our real world, and this is a prime example of those artificially engineered synchronicities we were discussing earlier. But without getting into too much detail, there's a pattern. There are connections between Aurora and Sandy Hook that are fact, and then if you extrapolate out one more event, assuming that it's a trifecta, there is a scenario that really, really is compelling and involving yet another major Hollywood production that was originally scheduled for release on December 25th, 2012, but was moved to May 10th. And the May 10th is the date in question, and it's part of what I call a triple crescent moon, I think trifecta is the term that I used, but the 9/11 had a strong astrological component, and the pinned to the occult calendar, and then there were some other the date was significant itself. It had connections to Thoth, which is the Egyptian version of Hermes, if you will, and so that you've got that continuity there between the Hermes and Thoth. And without jumping back into 9/11 too much, there were other sort of points of astrological significance on 9/11 that I detail in one of the chapters in the book, and the framework for this Aurora Sandy Hook May 10th event is built on that same sort of documented astrological framework, if you will. It's very reminiscent of what was done on 9/11, but in this instance, you've got three events on three separate dates that are connected through a lunar ritual. And again, it's you start stacking up the evidence and looking at the points and creating the connections, and you just are left with some conclusions that you'd just rather not consider. But we've seen it before, and the movie in question.
Let's give people just a little bit of. I mean, I know people who listen to this show are familiar. I've covered it a couple of times. I've talked about the Dark Knight and the Hunger Games similarities. I mean, obviously. You know, Sandy Hook shows up on the map in The Dark Knight. That's probably right. The creepiest and most aggressive bit of foreshadowing that you could even do. Obviously, there's a lot of weird stuff with James Holmes and people saying both of these cases, people say they've seen multiple shooters. And then you got in Sandy Hook, you also have the coroner. His name was Carver. That's just odd. I mean, we had Mark Wiener, the politician, showing his wiener. We have Bernie Madoff, who's made off with all your money. Like, you know, it all seems fake. And so that's another. The other weird thing is the Sandy Hook actors. You know, you got that that guy, Robbie Parker. He's laughing before he starts talking about his dead daughter. These are very weird. And I missed that detail that this movie was originally supposed to come out on December 25th, because you had a big prediction about that day. Obviously, we're past there, but I mean, they moved this date, and that would have also fit with those three movies all kind of being like a couple of months apart. But if they moved this to May 10th, there are some reasons that you talk about, but I just wanted to give that little bit that we're talking about. In terms of Sandy Hook, the movie we're talking about is Hunger Games, you know. That's the connection there, because the author who wrote The Hunger Games is from Aurora. That it's a story of killing of kids. You know, that's what the whole story is about, the whole trilogy. You show the Ring of Fire is their symbol. That symbol also showed up in part of the Olympic ceremonies, which was just full of symbolism. It was kind of gross. It was kind of, you know, insulting. But I just wanted to give that little bit of information. So we're talking about The Dark Knight, we're talking about The Hunger Games, and then this third movie that might complete this trilogy of the ceremony of the crescent moon What's that movie going to be?
Well, it's The Great Gatsby, and it fits in perfectly. It's, of course, a different genre, but in terms of tone and theme and the you know, the underlying psychology, it just fits right in with the Dark Knight and The Hunger Games, which was, by the way, released on a evening that was a crescent moon, and that even though the, you know, the, of course, the tie-in there is that the author of The Hunger Games just happens to live in Sandy Hook, but you've got this, again, this interplay between reality and fantasy, and that's what they're trying to blur the lines between reality and fantasy, and that's a key element and theme in The Great Gatsby. And the so you've got, like you said, there's really sort of this trinity of movies with a very similar, you know, sub themes and messages that in their, and on each instance they've used film to either foreshadow reality or, you know, somehow that it's mixed in there. So combined with all the other evidence and the sort of the astrology of it, I present some possibilities for what might happen in or on May 10th, and it's keyed to one of the locations in the book, and that's the area of Flushing, New York. Of course, you get that neat little toilet reference there, Flushing, and so who knows if that has anything to do with it, but it's at the time that Gatsby was written, was known as, this area was known as the Valley of the Ashes, and it's a real location that you can identify that Fitzgerald worked into the book. And there's a sports stadium located on that very property. And of course, in the Batman film, you've got a mass attack on a sports stadium. So there's just lots of interesting possibilities. Again, you can't say with any certainty what's going to happen. But I thought this was interesting enough with enough sort of possible foreshadowing and some really compelling connections that I wanted to present it. And well,
that place
that
place is also on the map in The Dark Knight, right? I mean, it says Target 1 Sandy Hook, and there is a Target 2.
Yeah, that it was funny. When I first thought about, I guess I read online, somebody was talking about, you know, the Strike Zone 2, and they thought they'd figured out where Strike Zone 2 was, and I thought, well, they're not going to do that again. That's too predictable. That's ridiculous. And I just forgot about it. And so I went through this exercise and, you know, came down and developed a scenario for an attack on this sports stadium and you know, had that outlined pretty well. And then I just happened to look back at that map. If you accept the map of Gotham is based on a map of New York, and you look physically where it's located, and you kind of overlay the two, this location is exactly where Strike Zone 2 is on that map that was in the Batman: The Dark Knight Rises, and my jaw hit the floor when I saw that. Now, that's not definitive. Doesn't mean it's an absolute given that something's going to happen there, but it's really sort of spooky. You know, people are already on edge. You had, you know, some guy claimed he'd figured out where the next attack was going to be, and somebody sent a link to the state police. Next thing you know, every school in the county was closed down for a day while they briefed the teachers and the administrators. And I mentioned, I just have a short paragraph on that in the book, but that's the environment we're operating in now, where someone can just really, based on loose evidence, sort of throw a theory out there, and the next thing you know, you've got the sheriff, the state police, the chief of police closing school down for a day and pulling all the administrators together to you know, give them a briefing on the issue. I mean, the line between fantasy and reality has been blurred. It continues to be blurred. And so, you know, we don't know what sort of creative garbage they have planned for us next, But if it's not this ring of fire, triple crescent moon ritual, then it'll be something else just as gruesome. So
right. And I've tried to do that before in the past. I've tried to take what I know from the conspiracy world and try to predict some events. But it's important to note, like, this is not Ken's premonition. He didn't, meditate on this and come up with it out of the ether. I mean, this is just looking at the way they operate and finding some connections that could be made. And the importance of it is that if something does happen on May 10th in connection to the Great Gatsby, it should validate for the listener that these are not random events. If you had any doubt already that they were satanic and that they were pre-planned, I mean, this should do it for you, you know. And I think it's a really interesting concept. And when you look at that stadium, you said there's a stadium there on that ground. It's in Pittsburgh, I believe, or is it the Pittsburgh Stadium?
Or is the Mets? Pittsburgh Stadium was the one that they actually filmed in for the Dark Knight
Rises.
That's
right. That's the connection. So
this is Citi Field, located in Flushing Meadows Park in Flushing, New York.
And then they're playing Pittsburgh on that day. Was that the connection?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's crazy. It's in the movie. They use the Pittsburgh Stadium. Pittsburgh is playing them on that day, and that's the day The Great Gatsby comes out. Is that the day? The release date?
Yeah, it is.
Kind of crazy. And to top it off, icing on the cake, Citi Field is Citibank. The Citibank symbol above the eye. What are we looking at above the eye on the Citibank symbol?
A beautiful red crescent.
Boom. I mean, I read that piece. I thought it was amazing. I think it's 22 pages. Anybody should go and read it. You got now until May 10th before they shut off the internet and throw us all in the FEMA camps. I just think it's really interesting, and I love that predictive kind of stuff, as long as it's not, I'm not really into the whole, psychic predictions, but I do like the concrete, you know, kind of Sherlock Holmes type of predictive events, but
yeah.
It's crazy. The other, there was something else about it that was also really weird. There's a lot of things that you wrote there, but there was another thing I was going to point out. That's right. The production designer of The Dark Knight, because I've wondered about this. I'm like, The Dark Knight has all this weird shit in it. It even has, we talked to Sandy Hook, it even has on the, there's, when it has a view of the skyline of the city, one of the buildings says Aurora on it really big. So you got Sandy Hook and Aurora. And I'm like, how did all this shit get in The Dark Knight? Because there's also a lot of ties to the old comic from 1985 where a guy with red hair goes into a theater and shoots people, and then John Holmes dyes his hair red, and then when the stadium collapses, they focus on the player with 85 on his jersey. Like, it's ridiculously focused. I mean, I'm not just grasping straws here. It's the focal point of the shot. And I'm like, how'd all this shit get in The Dark Knight? But the production manager or the production designer of The Dark Knight is Nathan Crawley, who is has relation to Aleister Crowley.
I think it's his great grandson, I believe.
Yeah.
And then let's say there was, it was like the maybe the prop manager was from Sandy Hook, and the set designer or the prop designer was from was Aleister Crowley's great grandson. I mean, again, these absurd linkages, and just dripping with occult significance and sort of smacking of and just outright mockery, just like you found throughout 9/11, and you get with the Aurora, Colorado shooting. I mean, you've got that here with just in spades. It just they might be incredibly twisted, but they are certainly fond of, using their dark humor. They enjoy a good laugh, apparently, at our expense, might add.
Man, yeah. Do you think the reason for these? Well, you actually write in the book, you say that occultists believe that numbers contain inherent spiritual and temporal power, and that to launch a plan without incorporating the proper occult power numbers could doom the plan to failure. that the reason for all this numerical coincidence? Is just boiled down to that statement, or is there more to it? Do you think this is just like a superstition that they hold, or do you think there's like real energy, like some type of real tools that are natural to the earth that we just don't understand?
I think probably the latter. I would, and it if you're just thinking about say the number 11, and you're just thinking about that being used on the airplane, and okay, what real power could that have? I mean, why would that really make a difference? Okay, maybe it creates a reference to Aleister Crowley, and maybe it's a number of magic, but what difference does that really make? Well, you could argue it wouldn't make a lot of difference, and maybe there's, you know, in addition to everything else that they do that might be legitimate, might have some sort of ritualistic effect and might actually produce some sort of supernatural effect. Maybe that's not, maybe that is just sort of carryover superstition and doesn't do anything. You know, and I tended to think that for a while, but then as you understand numbers as symbols and then and put them and then think about the impact of symbols on the subconscious, and then put the number in combination with the symbols and then with all the other things that we don't understand about how magical acts work and the incantations and just outright sorcery. You know, we don't really know, we probably aren't aware of exactly everything that the numbers represent. So I'd tend to hold that question open and say, all right, it might just be some superstition there, might be, you know, an artificially engineered synchronicity for kicks, or there could be more to it than we're aware. And of course, there are things about all of this that I'm sure I'm completely ignorant of, but there are many people who put a lot of stock in both white and black magic, and I would just certainly hope that there are practitioners of white magic that are as adept as these black magicians are. We're really in a lot of trouble.
No kidding. Well, hey man, that about does it. I mean, it's been quite a ride. There's a ton more in the book too. I mean, if anyone out there still thinks there's a chance we're not completely fucked, then pick up The Most Dangerous Book in the World, and I advise you to check out Kent's blog and his ebook, 22 pages of steamy conspiracy porn, and I mean that in the best way possible. Kent, can you give the people your website?
It's themostdangerousbookintheworld.com, and there's a blog section, and then there's a browse section, and there are a couple of, I believe the browse section is where we've got that free ebook, and there's a contact form if listeners or readers have any questions. Be glad to answer questions, and I've really enjoyed doing your show.
Nice, man. Adam, was there anything else you wanted to throw out before we let the man go?
No, fascinating conversation. Thanks, Kent.
Nice.
Yeah, enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show. It's been a real pleasure. I look forward to keeping up with your analysis of current events. Hopefully we can talk again in the future.
Sounds good. Take care.
All right, man. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
God damn. How was that? What'd you think?
Yeah, it was some good stuff, for sure.
Dark
it's,
stuff.
Funny, I was got a friend, buddy of mine. He's not really into the conspiracy research scene, but we went down to L.A. last weekend. He started talking about this book by Kent.
No way.
Yeah, I go, shit, we're going to be interviewing him in a couple days.
That's awesome. Synchronicities, yeah. Man.
Yeah, totally.
That's what makes me wonder. Sometimes I'm like, do these connections happen due to careful, meticulous planning, or is there just some mechanism in the universe that causes these things to unfold?
I think it's a mechanism in the universe.
Right, so then it goes into...
Of course, both?
Kent, I'm sure it's both.
Kent was talking about synthetic synchronicities too.
That's true. And that's something we talked about with Andy Coven last time you were here, is they try to create these things. Maybe it's because there is some type of, maybe there is some natural force that causes them, and the dark side just tries to imitate that force.
I don't know, man, but different book projects I've written on, for instance, The Prankster and the Conspiracy, the deeper I got down that rabbit hole, the more synchronicities I experienced.
Yeah, I've heard you talk about that. You want to give a couple examples of that?
Oh, man, I've forgotten most of them. But, the main one that kicked it off was I was considering writing the book on Thornley, gathering research material, and I thought if I ever have enough material, I'll write the book. And so, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Discordianism was co-founded by Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley. So around 2000, I got an unsolicited email, and this was at an email address that is a personal one. Nobody should have known about except friends and family. It's not something I have on my GoWritely website. And so I received an email from a guy named Bob Newport saying that Greg Hill had died. How he knew how to contact me, I have no idea. This was like in 2000. So I emailed him back and said, I asked, did you know Kerry Thornley as well? And Newport responded that he knew both Thornley and Greg Hill, and that he himself was a co-founder of Discordianism. And so I ended up interviewing him, and introduced me to a lot of other people like Robert Anton Wilson and a number of folks that had known Kerry Thornley. And this guy Newport ended up passing on to me the Discordian Archives several years later, which I'm using for all these projects in development. So Newport's kind of a magical fellow.
And,
I asked him, you know, a couple of years later, how did you know to contact me? And he had no idea.
Weird, man.
Yeah. And without that contact, I doubt if I would have written the book.
Yeah.
And so there was a bunch of synchronicities all through that. You know, it was just the little things that I was visiting Louise Lacey, who I interviewed for the book, and she had known Kerry real well, and I asked her if she had any photographs. And there was this one she was looking for, Kerry Thornley playing a harmonica, and she was looking all around for it, couldn't find it, and we got discussing something else, and she was running her hands over a bookshelf and showed me the book by Mickey Hart of the Grateful Dead on drumming. Luis had done research, helped him with that book. Later, after I left, she pulled out the book and opened it up, and that's that photo we were looking for of Kerry Thornley was in the book.
Wow.
Shit like that.
Yeah. I mean, those kind of synchronicities do seem a little more, obviously they seem more natural. They are still weird, and there's still like a paranormal aspect to it. But when you look at the 9/11 stuff and some of the stuff around these false flags, it's so meticulously planned that it's just like, I guess if you look at it from a conspiracy 101 point, you'll be like, yeah, some rich guys wanted to get some oil, so they flew some planes into some buildings and controlled the media, and they got away with it, and now they're over there fighting, getting oil and shit. And that's the basic idea. But when you go deeper, it's a lot more than that. Getting some oil and going over there and making a little bit of money, that's just icing on the cake compared to the real damage that's being done to the psyche. I mean, I can't even wear my shoes in an airplane, you know?
Yeah.
Will I ever be able to? Like, that's the thing. When does it end? But I mean, it just makes you feel hopeless. You know, everyone I know is working their ass off just to be broke. I'm coming into the real world at a time where a house isn't even a good fucking investment anymore. The media's version of reality has never been further from the truth. And people have too much pride to admit that they're one missed alarm clock away from losing their job. And, you know, it sucks. You know, that's not freedom. We're all just kind of waiting around for things to get better. But I think we're in the middle of something big, man. I really do. What do you think? Am I being dramatic?
I guess it's just your, you know, person's perspective. Maybe I'm in denial. All this crazy shit goes on, but figuring I'm going to try to be as positive and have as much fun while we can.
Groovy. I mean, yeah, what can you do, you know?
Yeah.
So, like,
It's like Kent was saying, This is the deal. This is the script. There ain't shit we can do about it. I think what we can do about it, and what his book, the reason for his book, is to wake people up so they see these patterns, you know. At least we can become aware of them. Right. But I also think, you know, on a deeper level, with this occult script and meticulously planned, as you said, what if this is happening on a subconscious level? What if it isn't that meticulous? It's just coming out of the mass collective conscious and subconscious of the planet.
That's true too. Like maybe there's some way that they're that synchronistic power of the universe, that whatever that is, maybe they're twisting that and harnessing it in a way that makes it blossom itself, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So weird shit, man. I'm not high enough for this anymore. But, you know, like we so often do when you're here, we close the show with one of your tracks. And what did you send me this time? What do we got?
I believe I sent you a track called Fields of Pain.
All right.
Is that right?
That is. Off
my second album, Songs for Another World.
What's that about?
What's the album about?
Well, that track. I would, based on the title, my guess was Crop Circles.
I'm not sure what it's about. It was like an instrumental thing I was working on, and sounds kind of dark and gloomy. There's heavy guitars.
Appropriate.
And there weren't really any lyrics, but as I was messing around, the ending of the song came, and I just repeat the lyrics, Fields of Pain. It's kind of like a nuclear holocaust thing or a zombie apocalypse.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because what that just jogged in my memory, another aspect of Kent's May 10th prediction is, you know, he's talking about the Ring of Fire. He's talking about the Crescent Moon and the trilogy. And when you put a Ring of Fire and Crescent Moon together, the symbol of the biohazard symbol, that's what that is. It's three crescent moons and a ring of fire, or a ring, you know. It could be a ring or whatever the fuck you want it to be. But in this case, it might be fire. So the biological thing, something that scares the shit out of me because it seems uncontainable. You know, that can get out of hand real quick. But at least it's over in New York and we're here in sunny California, right?
Oh, well, yeah. We're supposedly getting all the radiation from Fukushima.
That's true too.
On this end of the country.
But what's that going to do,
man?
That's just going to give you cancer, which we've probably already got anyway.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a pleasure, man. Always great talking to you.
On that uplifting note.
Yeah, but I do love having you on. I appreciate your weekly THC contributions. They're always fun to go over. People, Adam's column, Transmissions from a Dying Planet, appears once a week on thehighersidechats.com. Not so much on a specific day as planned, but and that's totally on my end. But it goes up once a week, and I do appreciate you sticking with it, man. It's awesome.
It's a pleasure, sir.
All right, man. Well, here's Adam Gorightly's Fields of Pain. It hurts so good, and I will see you guys next week. Be careful out there.